Hey Chris, it's Greg here. This guy, I forgot what his first name was. I could go back to the episode and see, but I'm just vibing with energy right now. Just drank an energy drink. Maybe I shouldn't have. But anyways, he said that we live in a post-apocalyptic world, that the apocalypse had already happened. And I think he's right. Like, he makes a good point here that the devastation of all these tribes and the conquering of the Americas by Europe, the conquering of Western thought and Western ideals, that was the apocalypse, right? But at the same time, we're always in a post-apocalyptic world. There's always going to be an apocalypse. Apocalypses, or in other words, the collapse of civilizations, happens periodically throughout the course of human history. It always happens. There's always some sort of event that collapses a civilization. Any kind of civilization at some scale, eventually it will collapse, just like the human body at some point will collapse. Everything collapses, but in this collapse, there's always a rebirth. And I think we need to keep in mind that while we're in the post-apocalyptic world, we're also in the pre-apocalyptic world. And someone somewhere is in an apocalyptic world. The people laying in their beds right now, in hospitals, dying from COVID or dying from whatever the fuck, they are in an apocalyptic world, an apocalyptic time in their life, because everything, as they know, will end. It will collapse right before their eyes. Anyways, what I'm trying to say here is that it's always the afternoon at every single time of the day. It's always afternoon, even at 11:59 a.m., because noon happened just the day before.
Radio Mano Papachango.
Afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, wherever you are, whatever time it is, it's afternoon. Can't disagree with any of that. It's always just before the dawn, always just after the dawn, always somewhere relative to dawn, sunset. And it's true, out of destruction comes creation. And out of death comes birth and all that profound shit. It's all true. Somehow it's not totally comforting, but yeah, I go around in circles with that stuff all the time. I mean, I'm watching the demise of the United States as a reputable superpower, but was there ever a time when I really felt an allegiance to the United States or actually believed in the United States as a reputable superpower? No. I was always pissing and moaning about the hypocrisies and the childishness and the global aggression being repackaged and sold as defending democracy. Yeah, come on. I grew up during the Vietnam War. That kind of cynical worldview was baked into the cake when I was, you know, a child. So it's interesting. I mean, there is that kind of feeling of sadness that I'm watching something fall apart. But on the other hand, it's something I've never really felt comfortable with in the first place. So why am I mourning it? I don't know. It's strange. Maybe it's like seeing a parent die with whom you've had a problematic relationship. And you say, well, you know, there are plenty of times when as a kid I said, I hope you die, or I thought it. But there's still a deep sadness in something that you've known, someone that you've known so long. The demise of this relationship is unavoidably something to grieve. A lot of confusion. I feel like there's confusion everywhere. In everything we look at, there's confusion. There's, you know, confusion is a negative way to look at it. Maybe nuance is the positive way. But, you know, here I am in Guatemala. And I was thinking the other day about the store Banana Republic. And back in the day, Banana Republic, when I was young, actually sold travel gear and like, you know, those fucking pants that you could unzip and take the legs off. So you'd have shorts and, you know, cargo pants and, I don't know, pith helmets. What's pith, by the way? What the fuck? And how does a pith helmet protect you from pith? But in any case, the phrase Banana Republic refers to this country. And the phrase comes from the fact that this country was basically owned by United Fruit Company. And they came in and they appropriated the land. Appropriated, by the way, is a fancy word for stole. And they set up all these banana plantations, and the people who had been pushed off their land, who didn't have any deeds or lawyers to defend their rights, were offered shitty jobs working in the banana plantations with all the pesticides and the chemicals and the horrible hours. And they were often paid in non-money. They were paid in private currency that United Fruit Company printed up that could only be used at United Fruit Company stores. So you're paid a shitty wage, you're kicked off your land, you're not allowed to support yourself on the land where you used to have pigs and chickens and a garden, because now that land belongs to us. And but we're offering you this really shitty job where you're going to breathe these chemicals and get hurt by machetes, and we don't give a fuck, and there's no medical clinics, and we don't take care of you because when you get hurt and get an infection and die, it doesn't matter. We'll just hire your kids or the next guy. And the money that we're giving you can only be spent in our stores that charge inflated prices. So you're always in debt because we'll give you a little loan and then you're in debt for the rest of your life. And then your kids are responsible for that same debt. How is this different from slavery? This is still going on today all over the world, this kind of shit. I just interviewed Ian Urbina about his book, The Outlaw Ocean. And he talks about how right now in Thailand, they will smuggle these guys in from Myanmar and they'll take them to a strip club and they say, okay, you guys just wait in here while we arrange, figure out where you're going to work and what you're going to do, because you're going to work on a fishing boat and da da da. But you wait in here for a couple hours. So you enjoy yourselves. So they're in a strip club, order a drink. Maybe they spend some time with some women, whatever. The guys come back and say, okay, got your job lined up. You had a drink and you were with this woman. And so you owe us $1,000. Oh, you don't have $1,000 because you're a refugee from Burma. Ah, okay. Well, all right, you can work it off. So they go into this job owing a ridiculous amount of money that they'll never be able to repay. That's slavery. That's the way it works. Anyway, that's what the term Banana Republic refers to. And when this country, Guatemala, elected a man named Arbenz in 1954, I think it was, or maybe he was elected in 52, And he said, you know what? This is crazy that this company comes in here and runs everything and just extracts wealth from this country and the people who live here get nothing. So we're going to talk about taxing the revenues of this company, this North American company, United Fruit Company, now known as Chiquita. I think they were bought by Dole. I'm not sure, but the company still exists. We're going to tax them on all this revenue, all this money that they're making on their bananas. And we're going to set up some medical clinics and some schools because 70% of the people in this country can't even read. And it's about time we started getting a little cut of all the money you guys are making here. And that's when United Fruit Company got together with the CIA and also the father of modern advertising. What's his name? He's Sigmund Freud's nephew. And they put together a plot to overthrow the government and take the company back for the United Fruit Company, which is what they did in 1954, I believe. You can read about all this stuff online. Anyway, that's the tragic, abusive history of the term banana republic. And how crazy that a fucking marketing guy decided that he was going to name the store Banana Republic. And people are going to think that was cool. People are going to go and buy their pith helmets at fucking Banana Republic. Bizarre. Anyway, listen, this is episode 499 of Tangentially Speaking. And this is Aroma. I've been saying I was going to do Aroma for a long time. Keep putting it off, largely because I've just had so many really interesting guests. And I feel like my own weird, warped thoughts can wait while we talk about that other stuff. But I wanted to say hello and thank you all personally, or as personally as this thing gets, for being here. Now, those of you who have been here for the whole ride, man, you're in the inner circle. And thank you especially. 500 episodes, it's been 9 years or something. It's crazy. I don't think I've ever done anything this long. And largely because I don't think I've ever enjoyed anything this much and felt this much freedom and this much alignment. It's awesome that I have this opportunity to talk to these people who only make time for me because you're on the other end of this. So thank you so much for giving me that leverage and access. Before I get into some of the other things I've got on my little notepad here that I wanted to talk about, I want to remind you or inform you that Sunday, the 24th of October, I'm recording this Friday. Hopefully this will go up later today, barring any technical glitches. So in 2 days, if you're listening to this right away, on Sunday the 24th, I'm going to be live streaming episode number 500. That's going to be co-hosted by Mike Marr, who has his own podcast called Take a Deep Breath, I believe, and Anya Kotz, who has her podcast, two of them actually, A Millennial's Guide to Saving the World, and the podcast that she co-hosts with our friend Aaron called Whore Rapport. Highly recommend both of them. Anyway, she, Anya, and Mike are going to be co-hosting, and I guess I'm going to be the guest on my own podcast, which will be interesting. And we'll be talking about a lot of the ins and outs of podcasting, what I've learned over the years. I should probably think about what I've learned over the years because I know they're going to ask me that question. Anyway, that's going to be at 2:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, Sunday the 24th. And it'll be recorded, so if you're hearing this too late or you're busy or whatever, you'll be able to go watch that on my YouTube channel. Chris Ryan is the YouTube channel. So check that out. The advantage to doing it live is you'll be able to ask your own questions or throw in comments or whatever and have us respond to that. I watched the Chappelle special. That's in the news. Everybody's talking about that. And, well, you can probably imagine where I come down on that. I thought it was funny. I thought it was funnier than the last couple that he's put up, which seemed very kind of self-congratulatory and a little mean-spirited. I felt this one, he's still talking about a lot of the same subjects, a lot of the cancel culture and the LGBTQ rage that's going on, and that is focused largely on him. And but he seemed to me to have more refined material. Some of the earlier stuff seemed more kind of just winging it. And this one seemed tighter. And I thought it was quite funny and insightful and what you would expect from him, risque, intelligent, slightly offensive in some ways, but in the service of humor, not mean-spirited. And I think a lot of what's going on in American culture right now is encapsulated in the Rotten Tomatoes review page for Dave Chappelle's latest special, which I looked at a couple days ago. And at that point, I don't know if you're familiar with Rotten Tomatoes, but they have a critic score and an audience score. And normally they're pretty close. There might be a 10% difference, you know, if the critics, you know, some artsy fartsy film that the critics really loved and normal people weren't that hot on, or vice versa. There could be something that the critics were, you know, saw flaws and normal people are like, yeah, but it was fucking entertaining. Anyway, the critic score for Dave Chappelle's last special, when I looked at it 2 days ago, was 43. They fucking hated it, trashed it. These are people who write for magazines and film review websites and newspapers. They did not like it, or at least that's what they're saying. The audience score was 96. I've never seen that big a difference between the critic score and the audience score on Rotten Tomatoes. I wonder if anyone's looked at that, if this is the biggest divergence ever between critics and public. But I think that sums up a lot of what's going on in American culture right now. And I think you can trace the rise of Trump to this. The space between what the experts are saying and what normal people are saying. That divergence opens up a power vacuum. It opens up a place for someone to come in and say, you know what? Fuck these experts. They're full of shit. I hear you. I know what you're saying. This is described as populism. That's the word that's thrown around to talk about a populist leader. And what's interesting is that populist or populism is normally used in the media as a term of denigration. It's a negative. Hitler was populist. Mussolini was a populist. And these Latin American leaders who come up and do things like Arbenz tried to do, you know, set up medical clinics and schools and take care of the people, they're populist. It's a dismissive term. But what the term means, if you look it up, it actually means a political leader who responds to the demands of the populace. How did that become a negative? How is that a dismissive term? That's where we are. We're in a place where for a politician to respond to the desires of the public is dismissed by the media as a negative. Bernie Sanders, populist. Fucking populist. That's all he is. Well, that's very strange. I had a really weird email a week or so ago. And this is related. I'll come back around. You'll see how. I get pitched guests for this podcast all the time. I guess I'm on some list that publicists get a hold of. And so when they blast out their emails trying to get attention for the latest Navy SEAL business management guru, or what was the one I got yesterday, was from some actress who was on Baywatch 20 years ago, who's turning 50 now and has a book about nutrition and, you know, whatever, how to stay beautiful. And, you know, like, are you kidding? Like, obviously they have no idea who I am or anything. They just see my name on a list of, you know, top podcasts or whatever. Anyway, I got this fucking email from a publicist who wanted to see if I was interested in interviewing Henry Kissinger. Yeah, Henry fucking Kissinger, who is co-author of a book that's coming out sometime soon about artificial intelligence. Yeah, artificial intelligence, Henry Kissinger. And at first I thought, like, is this some kind of a phishing email? Like, is this a, you know, targeted at me, so I'll click on some link and they'll get my bank data or something? Like, who could possibly think, A, that, you know, this podcast is worth the time of former Secretary of State, you know, Nobel Peace Prize winner Henry Kissinger? And secondly, that I would be the least bit interested in talking to Henry Kissinger or listening to him, even worse. Now, for those of you who might not know this, Henry Kissinger is kind of the face of the most evil aspects of American foreign policy. You know, Henry Kissinger is embodies the murderous, indifferent, what they called realpolitik, which means international geopolitical maneuvering with no concern for ethics, morality, the suffering of innocence or anything like that. No, this is real, right? These are the realists who are murderous fucking thugs who destroy entire cultures and ecosystems because, hey, that's the way the world works, which is, you know, another part of controlling language to promote a particular worldview. Somebody who calls themselves a realist. Hey, I'm just a realist. Like, what are they hiding in that wrapping? What are they slipping in? What pill have they wrapped in the bacon to give to the dog, right? I'm just a realist. No, you're not a realist. You're promoting a particular perspective on things, and you're cloaking it in this kind of fake innocence. Anyway, I decided to respond to the publicist, and I wrote back to her, and I said, I quoted Anthony Bourdain, and he wrote a little bit about, or maybe he said this, he wrote it. It's in A Cook's Tour, Global Adventures in Extreme Cuisines. And he said, once you've been to Cambodia, you'll never stop wanting to beat Henry Kissinger to death with your bare hands. You will never again be able to open a newspaper and read about that treacherous, prevaricating, murderous scumbag sitting down for a nice chat with Charlie Rose or attending some black tie affair for a new glossy magazine without choking. Witness what Henry did in Cambodia, the fruits of his genius for statesmanship, and you will never understand why he's not sitting in the dock at The Hague next to Milosevic. So I sent her that quote, and then I said, I've been to Cambodia. And much to my surprise, she wrote back. And she said, thank you, understood. Like, all right, interesting. So I guess Henry Kissinger will not be appearing on my podcast, but I thought it was pretty interesting that that for a moment there, it looked like our paths were going to cross. Henry Kissinger, in the world of politics and war and all that nonsense, is, you know, he's like one of these critics who gives the Chappelle special a 43. He's the elite. I think he taught at Harvard or Princeton or one of those places. And, you know, he goes to all the black tie affairs, as Bourdain said, and hangs out with the billionaires and goes to Davos and all that. And I think we're seeing this split between people like that and the rest of us, which is creating all kinds of very disruptive, difficult experiences for people. But I can't help thinking, yeah, tear it down, because that shit's fucked. The fact that Henry Kissinger could bomb the entire country of Cambodia, blow it to shit. And what Bourdain's responding to there is the fact that if you've been to Cambodia, you've seen how sad it is. It's an entire culture of destruction. He blew the fuck out of that country, broke all the laws, no declaration of war, denied that they were bombing it. They were bombing it because the Viet Cong was running weapons through Cambodia. And so they started this secret bombing campaign. This is during the Nixon administration. So I understand a lot of you, this is ancient history. But if you go to Cambodia, you'll see a country still on its knees. Because what happened was, after Kissinger and Nixon decided to bomb the fuck out of this country totally illegally, a country that wasn't involved with the war, a guy named Pol Pot took over. And Pol Pot, in the destruction of Cambodia, decided that it was time to create a utopian society of workers, and that any kind of elite intelligence was a sign of evil and needed to be ruthlessly removed from the culture, because these elites were corrupt and they would only corrupt the decency of common people. Now, I don't know that Pol Pot tied this back to the elites of Henry Kissinger and the Americans and Nixon and Ivy League educations and all that kind of shit, but this was his philosophy, that the elites were corrupt, corrupting, and needed to be cleaned like dirt out of a wound. And so what he did was he set about murdering everyone in Cambodia with an education. All the doctors, all the teachers, the journalists, any kind of professional, took them out to the fields and shot them. It got so bad that anyone who wore eyeglasses was killed, because eyeglasses were seen as evidence of some sort of elitist, upper class corruption. How long does it take a country to recover from the mass murder of everyone with any education, with any intellect that's been recognized and cultivated? That's Cambodia. And Henry Kissinger bears responsibility for that. So he's one of these elites. He's one of these people who says, I know how to shape the world. I'm a realist. And then you have people like Bernie Sanders, who says, or Arbenz, or Allende in Chile, or many examples of this around the world. Just look at the list of people assassinated by the CIA in the last 50 years, and you'll see some of the most prominent idealists right there who say, no, the money should go to taking care of people. We should tax the extremely wealthy, to help the rest of us. Well, those people get assassinated. Those people are, their characters are assassinated because they're populist. And if that doesn't work, then their bodies are assassinated. That's the way it works. So I've got no sadness about the fact that these elites are being recognized as such and being criticized. But the problem is this leaks into so many other areas of life, and you get this these crazy schisms. And somehow, I think this same historical tidal movement is expressed in what's going on with Chappelle, circling back to that. And the rage of many of the leading voices in the LGBTQ community, as if that's a community. That's another thing. Like, is that a community? It's or is it like a Twitter movement or something, you know, that's led, as always, by the loudest and most vehement and least nuanced representatives. So you have, it almost reminds me of watching soccer matches, especially involving Italians, where any opportunity to act as if you've been injured is leveraged in the most dramatic fashion in order to gain some advantage. If you can convince the ref that that guy tripped you or kicked you or pushed you or something, and you roll around and hold your knee and, oh my God, oh, it hurts so bad, and the ref calls a foul or gives the guy a yellow card or even better, a red card, kicks him out of the game or gives you a penalty, you get a point, you get a free point. It's amazing. You're going to win. You're going to win for your team because you pretended to be hurt by something that actually didn't fucking happen. And if it did happen, if he did kick you or trip you or something, it didn't hurt you, but you pretend it did, because pretending it did gives you advantage. And I feel like that's what's happening with all these screaming, angry mobs demanding that the Dave Chappelle special be pulled from Netflix because words are violence. Because these jokes make me feel unsafe. Like, what? No, you're just rolling around on the floor here. I read something really interesting recently, which I highly recommend to you. It's by a woman named Molly Francis. It's her Substack. Just go to mollyfrancis.substack.com and look for My Non-Binary Gender Identity. She is a woman who came out as non-binary a few years ago and now has decided that that was something that didn't really work for her. And she's not saying, to be very clear, she's not saying all people who decide they're non-binary are motivated by the same kind of stuff that she was motivated by, or that they're not sincere or not real or whatever. She's not saying that at all. But she's just talking about her own experience. And she says, I see my traits through non-binary identity in retrospect as a sad, embarrassing fetishization of my own disarray in a last-ditch effort to find stability in an alienated world. There's a lot in that sentence. And I think there's a lot of truth in that sentence. I think a lot of what's going on that seems unrelated is in fact a response to the instability and fragmentation and chaos in the world. And we are seeking any kind of identity, like a desperate person when the ship's gone down and you're just looking for something that floats to grab onto, whatever. It doesn't matter what it is. It could be a bloated corpse, you'll grab onto it to stay afloat. And I think that's what's happening. People are grabbing on to anything, any kind of identity, any kind of group that makes them feel some sense of safety. So let's read that again. I see my traipse through non-binary identity in retrospect as a sad, embarrassing fetishization of my own disarray. In what ways are we all fetishizing our own disarray? In a last-ditch effort to find stability in an alienated world. She goes on, the world is bleak. It always has been. But right now, it has a particular strain of surreal, disjointed bleakness that has lent itself to obsessive self-fixation in a scrambled search for security in words that perfectly capture some essence of ourselves. One avenue for this is in gender, something so individual, yet so compulsorily social. It's private enough to suit an alienated world, but public enough to solicit connection and mirroring even from strangers. I am, somewhat narcissistically, declaring special status for fighting the universal battle of human nature. We are all consciousness bound up by the constraints of an animal body, constantly in battle between our impulses and our ideals. And there's so much wisdom in what she writes, and I really recommend, if you get a chance, that you read the whole thing. It's fascinating and written from a very informed perspective. And then we see something like the statement from GLAAD in response to the the Dave Chappelle special. GLAAD is the Gay Lesbian Alliance network. And they say, Netflix has a policy that content designed to incite hate or violence is not allowed on the platform. But we all know that anti-LGBTQ content does exactly that. So they're saying Dave Chappelle making jokes about this stuff incites hate or violence. But if you listen or watch his special, he's trying very hard to show that he's not trying to incite any hate or violence. Discussing these issues is just that. It's a discussion of the issues. The problem that I see is that these discussions are considered off limits and lead people to roll around on the ground holding their knees, pretending they were fouled. What's her name? J.K. Rowling is considered transphobic because she has dared to say women who were born girls and grew up as women are different in important ways from someone who transitions from male to female in their 30s. She's not saying they're less. She's not saying they don't deserve rights and legal protections and so on, but she's saying, can we stop pretending that there is no difference? And she's right. And Chappelle talks about this in the special as well. If you cannot acknowledge a difference between someone born in a female body and someone born in a male body, then you're denying reality. And the incredible vehemence and rigidity around this conversation only goes to show how weak that position really is. Men and women are different. Now, that doesn't mean that there's only one way to be a man or one way to be a woman, or that there aren't people born with bodies that are somewhere in between. That happens. It's very, very rare, but it does happen. But it's so strange that someone who decides they were born in the wrong body and they want to transition from, let's say, male to female, how can that person argue that there's no difference and that gender is entirely determined by cultural norms? And yet that person also is willing to have a series of surgical interventions and take hormones in order to inhabit that other gender more accurately. Well, on one side, they're saying the body doesn't matter. On the other side, they're saying change my body to bring it more into alignment with who I am. I don't see how those two positions can possibly coexist. Having said all that, the reason I read that quote from Molly Francis is that I think it's important to understand that a lot of this anger, maybe as all anger, is a response to fear. It's a response to feeling, as she said, that she was looking for an identity in a fractured world, in an alienated and fractured world. And we're all doing that. And so while I disagree with a lot of what's going on in this particular culture world, and I'm just waiting until, you know, they target me, and maybe this will be the straw that broke the camel's back, I don't blame anyone for feeling afraid and desperate and panicked and turning to these group identities as a way to find some sense of safety. The world's going through a real convulsion right now. And I think we're all suffering from cultural level PTSD. I feel like there are very few pockets of stability and safety, and everyone's looking around and seeing the shit hitting the fan, and we're all reacting in different ways. And some people are reacting with anger and trying to find allegiance with groups, whether it's the fucking, you know, Proud Boys or angry, vindictive LGBT protesters or, you know, whatever. We're all just trying to get through. And I hope you're doing all right. And I hope that you are able to choose to get through by bonding with people you love and taking care of each other and not attacking anyone else. And I certainly hope that nothing I've said came across as an attack, because I don't mean it that way, except for Henry Kissinger, who can go fuck himself. I'm going to play you out with a tune that is one of my favorite. I don't know if we call this a protest song or a revolution song, but it's definitely a response to the kind of political, smug, political, elitist, we know what we're doing, you guys just go fuck off, that I was referring to either earlier. It's called You Haven't Done Nothing. It's by Stevie Wonder. I'll just read some of the lyrics so you see what I'm talking about. He says, "We are amazed but not amused by all the things you say that you'll do." Right. Didn't Joe Biden say he was going to cancel student debt or something, or at least a big chunk of it? And he put together a commission that was going to report back in 6 months. Well, that was way more than 6 months ago. You're not doing nothing, Joe. Back to the song. "But we are sick and tired of hearing your song, telling how you're going to change right from wrong. Because if you really want to hear our views, you haven't done nothing. It's not too cool to be ridiculed, but you brought this upon yourself. The world is tired of pacifier. We want the truth and nothing else. We would not care to wake up to the nightmare that's becoming real life. But when misled, who knows, a person's mind can turn cold as ice. Why do you keep on making us hear your song, telling us how you're going to change right from wrong? Because if you really want to hear our views, you haven't done nothing. Yeah. All right, Stevie Wonder, you haven't done nothing. Thank you for listening to me rant and rave. I'll be back on Sunday with episode 500 with Mike and Anya. Thank you for your attention. Thank you for your support of this podcast, however it manifests. I appreciate it very much. Much love to everybody.
You brought this up on